these four foundations that we're exploring this week. The foundation of wisdom, of truth, of relinquishment, and of peace. In a way, with the associated actions or practices with each of those, can be seen as a kind of a natural unfolding of the practice, of the path, the direction that we're headed. And we can begin, the practice begins by not neglecting wisdom, by orienting towards these teachings that point towards the truth. And as we engage in these practices, we come to more deeply connect with the truth primarily of impermanence. That truth of impermanence, pointing out that whatever there is that's impermanent, all experience is impermanent, is unreliable as a source for lasting happiness. And the conditionality tumbling on is not self. And these are the truths that this wisdom, the direction, the orientation of practice of not neglecting wisdom points to. And as we start to get a taste of those truths, as we start to understand those truths in our being through the practice, the relinquishment's a very natural result. We talked about the abandoning of acquisitions coming because of understanding the non-value of those reactive states of mind. Understanding the danger of those reactive states of mind, the mind begins to naturally let go of them. So that release of those reactive states based in greed, aversion, and delusion leads to peace. And so it can be seen as both, these foundations can be seen both as a path of practice and the result of practice. One thing I find interesting in this text that we've been looking at with Pukkusati and the Buddha sitting together in the potter's shed, and the Buddha offering these teachings to him that night, kind of in the form of a guided meditation. The guided meditation that the Buddha offers Pukkusati is a pretty, what would you say? It's pretty direct, and it's pretty hard to see, you know. He starts right with, just notice the elements, they're not me, not mine, not who I am. You know, how many of us can start there? Just suddenly turning to our bodies and saying, yes, this is stardust, not me, not mine, not who I am. We end up with a lot of reactivity when we turn to our experience. We see the confusion, we see the aversion, we see the desire for things. We want things to be other than they are. And that's a lot of what we are working with. I find it interesting that the commentaries of the sutta point out that that the Buddha, in sitting down with Pukkusati, understood that he already had a very deep practice. Basically, he could get to equanimity at will. And so he started him directly with looking at insight into direct experience. And so I thought tonight I would explore another path that the Buddha offers. The Buddha offered so many different descriptions of the path in the texts. And there's another journey through our lives that's described in another sutta. And I thought I would explore that one and look at some of the ways in which these two connect, these two paths connect. They're not really different paths. Maybe they're different descriptions of the path. So the sutta that I would like to explore tonight is called The Simile of the Cloth. It's Majjhima number 7. And this sutta begins with a simile. The Buddha is talking to some of his followers and starts with this analogy. Suppose, he said, that you have a cloth that's stained. You know, it's been hanging around in the dirt. And so you take this cloth that's got all of these dirty spots on it, and you dip it into a vat of dye and bring it up. And would that cloth then look purely colored by that dye? And they said no. I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried dyeing things. I remember at one point I had a stain on a white shirt, and I thought, oh, I'll just dye it a different color. That'll get rid of the stain. It doesn't work that way. The stain picks up the dye, and it's a slightly different color than the rest. And so when you have a stained cloth and you dip it into dye, it doesn't absorb the color evenly or purely. And so he's pointing to that in this simile. If the cloth is stained, it's not going to take up the color evenly. But a cloth that is clean, pure, will take up the dye evenly. And so he compares this to our minds. He said, when our mind is stained, using this analogy, when our mind is stained by reactivity, by the reactive states of greed, aversion, delusion, and he gives a great list here. Covetousness and greed are imperfections of mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence are stains in the mind. So this is a list of what we get to look at, right? This is what we see in our minds, these kinds of states. And so I like this, that the Buddha starts here. He starts from where we are. With Pukkasati, he started from where Pukkasati was, which was able to go into equanimity at will. That's not most of us. And so here in this text, he's starting from these reactive states. And what does he say to do? He says, we need to understand these reactive states and abandon them. So that work, the same work of relinquishment, is pointed to in this text as in the one with Pukkasati. So we turn our mindful attention to these states. The work of the practice really is to understand, bring wisdom to these states. As I talked about the other day, that as we turn with understanding, open to our reactive states with mindfulness and a perspective of wisdom, there's a natural understanding that begins to result that helps the mind to release those states. You know, I talked about that sometimes we can actively let go, but most of the time we get to see the clinging. Much of the time we can't say, clinging? you're not useful anymore. I'll just set you down. At least in my mind, that's not how it works. And so turning over and over again with mindfulness towards the experience of clinging gives the mind the understanding it needs to look to learn and move towards abandoning the clinging. And so as our minds begin to see their contribution to the suffering that we are experiencing, the mind begins to understand how to let go. So I like this. To me, this is inspiring to hear that the Buddha points to, and this is actually what he says in the First Noble Truth, understand suffering, that's our work. That's what we do, we understand suffering. Not with the agenda, an aversive agenda to get rid of it, but with the interest and curiosity to see how does this work in the mind? How does this clinging function? You know, Gil talked this morning about looking at, nothing is worth clinging to. And yet when we are clinging, our minds are somehow telling us, yes, this one is worth clinging to. You know, so why are our minds telling us that? What's going on there? Be curious about that. And as the mind begins to understand that, it starts to let go. In my own practice, there has been so much, this has been so much a part of the path. I think I said the other day, you know, I kind of used to think that the path was supposed to unfold kind of like it did for Bukkisati. You know, you get to equanimity and then good things happen. For me, much more of the practice has unfolded right in the midst of opening to these reactive states, right in the midst of knowing the arising of self-hatred and seeing it so clearly, the mind understanding something about it in that moment. At times, releasing it and seeing the release from that suffering. So much of the path of practice can unfold right through the meeting of these reactive mind states. Deep, liberating insight can arise right as we're observing reactivity. As I started to see this for myself, I stopped having such a contentious relationship with my difficult mind states and began recognizing this is the path of practice. This is how it unfolds. Doing the best I can to meet and open to these reactive states of mind. The path that is described in this sutta. The next step in this simile of the cloth sutta basically says, when one has known these stains in the mind and they have been abandoned, for me it's more that feeling, you know, the there are times when abandoning feels like an active thing, but more it feels to me like the activity of practice is in the meeting with mindfulness and wisdom. The abandoning is the work of wisdom. That's so much my experience. At times it feels like, yes, I can actively abandon, but more it feels like the abandoning happens through wisdom. And so I'll reframe these words a little bit. So when one has known these imperfections, when one has fully understood these imperfections, they are abandoned. They become abandoned. Wisdom abandons them. In that, there is an arising of confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. These three refuges that we explored the very first night. Confidence in the path of practice, confidence in the possibility of freedom and confidence in the community of practitioners that offers the support to help us awaken. I remember one time, this just kind of popped into my mind, Ajahn Sumedho was talking about these three refuges and pointed out that, you know, the confidence in awakening, the confidence in the path of practice, those may have a more natural resonance for us. But sometimes when we see the human nature of the people in the Sangha, it's harder to take refuge in that. You know, people make mistakes. And Ajahn Sumedho started talking about that and said, you know, what I recognized is it's not so much that I'm taking refuge in the individuals, but I'm taking refuge in the community and the direction that the community is supporting. And he even made the comment, take refuge in the individuals at the monastery? I don't think so. So, you know, it's the community and the direction of the community. And we have to understand that, you know, even our teachers can make mistakes. So this confidence arises in the possibility of awakening, the path of practice, the direction of the teachings that the Buddha offered, and the support that we receive from our communities. The texts here say that at a certain level of understanding and abandoning the defilements, the phrase is unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha arise. That phrase, unwavering confidence, it's kind of coded sutta speak for having realized the first stage of awakening, having touched into the first possibility, the first taste of freedom, having seen truly that freedom is possible. So the work of the understanding the reactive states is what leads to this confidence, using the teachings, exploring with mindfulness and this perspective of worthwhile to recognize, oh, anger's arising, this is what that experience is, instead of following it. So using those teachings to understand the reactive states of mind and see how they can start to let go. You know, that experience when we actually see how wisdom releases the defilements, wisdom releases those kilesa, that's the word often translated as stain. This sutta, we could call it the stain sutta. You know, it uses this word kilesa, and that often is translated as the word defilement. I slip into that every now and then, that word defilement. It's not a word that is very well received in English. It's not. It has a connotation that is creates some challenge for the mind to hear. But in this sutta, it's the reason for the use of it is because he's comparing the reactive states of mind to stained cloth. And so that's the word for stain. You know, you say the cloth has got kilesa, it's stained. It's got that, you know, so that word kilesa basically means stain. And so I actually checked this word out before I came today, and I discovered actually to my surprise that this word kilesa is not used very often in the suttas. It's I think, in some of these text with analogies, it's used. But in the later tradition, this word kilesa became much more prominent. And so, you know, really, what this is referring to, these reactive states of mind, are the states based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And as we start to see how wisdom can release these states. That turning with mindfulness and being willing to observe reactivity, that the reactivity can find its own way to release, that brings a lot of confidence in the teachings, in the path of practice. So this unwavering confidence, there, at a certain point of having seen through these reactive states to a certain level, the unwavering confidence, no longer any doubt in the possibility for awakening, even as there's still a lot of work to do in the understanding of the kind of arc of awakening. There's this teaching of different levels or stages of awakening. And the first stage of awakening is said to be kind of the taste of really recognizing in a moment the possibility that the mind could be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. For just maybe a split second, it sees that possibility that it's possible for a mind in a moment to be free from greed, aversion, and delusion. And with that taste, while the mind then picks all reactivity back up after that moment, there's the understanding. It's like there's something that's been cleared away where the mind understands, ah, yes, it's possible. And these states of reactivity are, they're stains. They're visitors. They can be scrubbed out. They can be cleaned. You know, that we can take the soap and water of mindfulness and do the work to cleanse, to release these reactive states of mind, these states based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And so, even with this very deep, unwavering confidence, there's still work to do. There's still a path of practice. And yet this confidence gives us the inspiration to continue. And that's the next place, the next piece in the sutta. When one has given up, abandoned, relinquished the reactive states of mind, one considers there's unwavering confidence in the Buddha, gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains inspiration and gladness connected with the Dharma. And so there is this inspiration to continue working with the understanding, working with the practices to meet and allow wisdom to deepen and grow, to free, so that it will free and release the reactive states of mind. So acquiring unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, there is inspiration in the Dharma, gladness in the Dharma. Then the next bit, again, is kind of interesting. It points to a natural, again, a very natural unfolding here. It says, when one is glad, rapture arises. When one is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels happiness. And one who is happy, the mind becomes concentrated. So this little paragraph includes a lot of, it's a natural unfolding, and this resonates for me with another text that's called The Lawfulness of Progress. It says, The Lawfulness of Progress says, you know, we start where we are again, you know, working with being ethical conduct, and it says, for one who is endowed with virtue, with ethical conduct. There's no need for an act of will. May non-remorse arise in me. It's a natural law that non-remorse will arise in one who's virtuous. In one free of remorse, there's no need for an act of will. May gladness arise. It is a natural law that gladness will arise in one free from remorse. In one who's glad at heart, there's no need for an act of will. May joy arise. It's a natural joy, a natural law that joy will arise in one who is glad at heart. Following from that, tranquility, happiness, concentration as a natural unfolding, a lawful unfolding. And yet, in my understanding of this, it is kind of the direction of the heart and mind, the direction the heart and mind moves as we gain confidence. As we gain confidence, the heart moves towards gladness. It's the overall direction. And yet, you know, we're turning a big ship. It's not, you know, boom, you know, confidence arises and boom, there's concentration. It doesn't quite work like that either. And so my understanding is that while this is kind of the natural direction, as there is confidence born, there's a natural direction towards more an increasing gladness of heart in the Dhamma, an increasing experience of tranquility of body, an increasing movement of happiness and concentration. It still takes some effort, some engagement. I don't have the understanding that once confidence arises, all we have to do is sit back and wait. That's not my sense of how this practice unfolds. And in fact, when that confidence arises, what's very natural, what the natural inspiration is that confidence connects to what it has understood, and that confidence wants to act. That confidence wants to head in the direction of deepening its understanding, deepening its wisdom, moving in the direction of concentration. So there is this movement in this direction, and yet still taking some kind of effort. The natural following, this sutta is very much in this frame of explore with wisdom and understanding the reactive states of mind. And that will kind of naturally lead you towards more and more freedom, more and more awakening. There's a text, I don't remember if we've quoted it, or maybe Gil quoted it, something along the lines of, you know, the path of practice, or the Eightfold Path inclines towards freedom. Just as all the rivers that come into a larger river, and that river leads to the ocean in a very natural way, the path of practice leads to freedom. So this sutta really is highlighting this natural direction, and the work of the practice in this description of the path lies in understanding the reactive states of mind. That's one way that a path would unfold. You know, Pukkusati, we didn't hear about his earlier path, but Pukkusati kind of could start with equanimity, and his path unfolded maybe in a slightly different way, or he was already at this place of concentration. So for me, this sutta is inspiring in this, the work of our practice lies right in the meeting of right where we are, nowhere else. And thank goodness, you know, that's all. It's like, this moment, this is all I have the opportunity to meet. And so this moment right here, this is the path of practice, whatever's arising right now. If it's reactivity, that's where I bring my mindfulness. That's the path right there. If equanimity is arising, that's the path. That's what I bring my attention to right there. In this simile of the cloth, the next gradual or the next natural development of arising is metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The text basically describes one who has this unwavering confidence moving towards this gladness of mind and this tranquility, the happiness and the concentration. The next thing it says is, and one abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Again, not that it's like a lot of work, but more almost that it's the natural arising based on the work of meeting the reactivity. That these states of love, of compassion, of sympathetic joy and equanimity, to me, what it's almost pointing to is that they are revealed as the path allows a letting go and an abandoning of the reactivity. It's like that enzyme of wisdom I was talking about, that the enzyme of wisdom kind of dissolves the reactivity and leaves what? It doesn't leave a lump that just sits there, oh, things as they are. It results in a mind that is imbued with love and compassion and joy and equanimity. And these qualities of mind, Gil at one point said this, and it's stuck with me all these years, that there are these qualities of mind, these four Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes, these flavors of love and balance of mind, they're the map or the emotional map of the awakened heart. That's what remains as the reactivity is released through wisdom. Equanimity, love, compassion, joy, wisdom become the ground out of which our being responds to the world, not in a passive way, but in a very active way. You know, sometimes as we work with reactive states, I mean, so much of our path of practice, at least in my experience with my own practice and in speaking to a lot of people, a lot of our work lies in meeting these reactive states, learning how to meet these reactive states. And so often in that exploration, we don't really see, or it's not so clear how love fits into this path. We bring in the metta practice actively. And yet, what I think is happening very much is that wisdom and the meeting of our reactivity actually is an act of love. When we talk about bringing a kind attention or a balanced attention to what's happening, and sometimes we can touch into the deep act of kindness that is for us and for the world to turn towards, to not reject, but also to not indulge in our reactivity. And so sometimes we might, in exploring our reactive states, be able to recognize that kind attention itself might be felt like ease or peace or stillness. This the pointing to, even as that stillness that Gil talked about, that waterfall with the little nest inside, you know, even as there's all of this stuff happening around you, the possibility of touching into the stillness. And I would suggest that mind of stillness that meets experience is also one of the kindest things that we can do for ourselves. And so sometimes we can touch into that flavor and sense of metta and compassion. They're coming along for the ride in our practice, whether we're aware of it or not. This was actually quite interesting in my own practice because my mind is pretty oriented towards wisdom, towards understanding, and so there was a lot of experience of balance of mind in meeting experience, and in meeting people as I sat and talked with them about their practice, a lot of sense of, you know, non-reactivity and just taking in what's there and responding to that. So a lot of that sense of equanimity, and sometimes what I would get reflected back is, you know, people would say, you know, speak back to me. Occasionally somebody would say, as I was working with them around some struggle or suffering, they'd say, "Wow, I just so feel your compassion." And I would take that in, but inwardly I'd think, that's not my experience. I don't feel that compassion. I wonder if there's something wrong with me that I'm not feeling that compassion. And thought, you know, well, it's not there, or I don't know, something. It's like maybe I need to go work at developing compassion or something. And I talked about this with a few teachers. And several of them just said, "Oh, it's there." It's like, I don't feel it. And one teacher had just the right instruction for me. He said, when you're in that place of just feeling so balanced, he said, you're orienting towards emptiness. You're orienting towards wisdom. He said, turn instead to the relationship, to the connection. And so the next opportunity I had, which was only minutes later, fortunately, I was sitting and talking to somebody, and I consciously kind of oriented my mind towards relationship instead of elements. And compassion was right there. It was there. But it did need to have somebody to help me recognize it. And so that, you know, that when there's a kind of a balance of mind, you know, sometimes there can be a little bit of work to do to expand how we meet the world. Meeting it through relationship and intimacy and connection. It's like the emptiness and the relationship they're two sides of a coin, and we can meet both, and that's, to me, that's where the heart qualities become more felt, is in relationship. I the other day when I was talking about relinquishment, I forgot to mention, and so I thought I'd bring it in here, the Pali word that this is translating. The Pali word is chaga. And that word which in this, in the sutta with Pukkasati, the discourse on the elements, it's pretty clear it's pointing to this relinquishment of letting go, of abandoning, of releasing, based on all of the words that are around it. And yet in other places in the suttas, this word chaga is used to refer to the heart that delights at giving, the heart of generosity. The word chaga in various contexts is translated as generosity. And so this work of relinquishment, it's beautiful to me to think of this, you know, this flip side of the relinquishment. You know, we think of relinquishment in the letting go perspective, but what happens on the flip side when we're in relationship is a heart of connection, of generosity. And so again, you know, it feels to me like the work of the wisdom is already touching these beautiful heart qualities. In my own path of practice also, I've seen the heart qualities revealed sometimes in connection with reactivity itself. I did mention the other day that so much of our reactivity kind of might have a wish for our well-being at the root of it, a wish for our own safety and happiness. I sometimes think of metta as, it is a wish for our well-being. And this wish for our well-being so often gets distorted by greed, by fear, by confusion. I think there is a very intimate connection between our suffering and this wish for well-being. Basically just misunderstanding where well-being is to be found in this short-sighted approach for where can I find happiness? How can I get the next moment of happiness? Again, thinking that getting something I want, getting rid of something I don't want is as good as it gets in terms of happiness. As we practice with mindfulness, I think mindfulness begins to reveal the unsatisfactory nature of this kind of immediate grasping for the next moment of happiness. And that kind of impels us or points us in the direction of maybe there's another way to happiness. I certainly found that in my own life that I thought, you know, I had tried everything that I could. Tried everything that I could to find happiness, and it just felt like I hit rock bottom. And it's like nothing had worked. All the ways in which I had been taught would lead to happiness, every one of them failed. And so this, maybe sometimes hitting rock bottom is what can take us to the place of kind of like a shift of how we engage, a shift of how we meet the world. One perhaps aligned more with the true nature of what happiness is, the true nature of the impermanent, unreliable, out of control nature of life. And so this willingness to explore our reactive patterns, I've seen many times, just through that willingness to turn towards meet depression, meet self-hatred, not try to fix it or change it, but when it was possible, at least, not always possible, but when it was possible to okay, this is depression. This is how it's experienced. Oh, caught by depression. Okay, that's what it feels like to really be gripped by depression. Oh, it let go. Oh, it's just depression. That's not, oh, and it's gone. What's back? Okay, oh, okay, this is depression. Just willing to go through that ride over and over and over again. It's like the mind begins to, I talked about that big messy ball of layered, complex, interwoven reactivity stuff. And, you know, just that willingness to meet it, to see it, to receive it. More than once, as I did that, there was some kind of opening, not something I was looking for, not something I was trying to do, but a kind of a recognition at some point by just being willing to meet that, oh, underneath this pattern is a wish for my own well-being and happiness. And when that wish or that movement of my own well-being and happiness was actually felt, there was a new way of understanding that whole pattern of reactivity. Not that it meant that that pattern went away, but just that there was a kind of a respect for the pattern. You know, these patterns of depression, of anxiety, of irritation, of confusion, you know, they're a misguided but somewhat well-meaning attempt to find happiness. And that it's like our minds in being in the field of our conditioning are doing the best they can to respond to the world. And so I think this is often why our struggles have such a grip on us, because they are connected often to this deep wish for happiness. And we feel sometimes that some part of our mind says, no, I can't let go of this pattern, because that's the only way I know to be okay. That's the only way I know to be okay. And so to me, what this points to is not to try to get rid of the pattern, to like throw it out, but to begin to understand it, to allow that enzyme of wisdom to begin to reveal what's tight, what's contracted, and what is actually that underlying wish for well-being, a wish for metta, which is a wholesome wish, a wholesome wish in our minds. And so these are some ways that I see that the qualities of love, of compassion, of joy are revealed and cultivated as we practice. And then the sutta goes on. It doesn't end with a mind of equanimity, of love, of compassion. The teaching points to non-attachment, even to these very beautiful mind states. It says in the text, you know, after describing these beautiful, measureless, boundless states, a mind imbued with loving kindness, exalted, immeasurable, a mind pervaded with compassion, without hostility, a mind imbued with joy, immeasurable joy, and a mind imbued with equanimity. The next place, place it goes in the suttas is to say, and what one understands of that, there is this joy, there is this equanimity, there is this compassion. this too is a conditioned, arising phenomenon not worth clinging to. Nothing is worth clinging to as I, me, or mine, including a deep state of equanimity or peace or joy or compassion. That might sound like a very dry life. You know, it's like, well, do we just go back to elements then, you know? Seems pretty uninspiring, maybe. But my understanding is really that the clinging to these states actually keeps the relationship from being fully flowering, keeps the heart from really entering into the terrain of love and compassion. Any clinging around these states will limit them in some fashion. So my understanding is that when perhaps the mind can release clinging even to these wholesome states, it doesn't mean that they stop arising. It doesn't mean that we stop acting. It doesn't mean that we stop relating. When I read about the Buddha's life in the texts, I see a person who was meeting kings and talking to them about how to avoid war, prevent war, meeting people, talking to them about their lives, meeting lay people and exploring what it might mean to wake up in the midst of their lives, trying to stop a war, a water war in his country. This being who was freed from greed, aversion, and delusion didn't stop acting. Action was the being was action. And my understanding, motivated by wisdom and compassion. And so this path of practice, starting from just meeting where we are, reactivity arising in the mind. I think this sutta really speaks from the perspective of our relationship to the world. It starts from this, you know, what is our usual relationship to the world? We have so much reactivity. Meet that. Turn to that. Recognize it. Begin to understand it. This understanding encourages a shift towards a relationship not to the usual way that we engage with the world, but a relationship of a dharma engagement with the world, a dharma engagement with our experience. And this points out that these reactive states don't serve ourselves very well. It doesn't serve the world very well. And there's a kind of a releasing of that slowly over time, gradual releasing of these reactive states. I take great heart in some of the analogies that the Buddha uses for the path of practice. One in particular that is an image that has stayed with me for some 10 years or so after I first learned it. And it's the image of a rotting rope. Did I talk about this in the hall? Did I talk about this? It's an analogy. The Buddha says, you know, the path of practice, you know, if you imagine a shipwreck, there's the parts of the ship that are strewn all over the beach, the rope, the rigging, the parts of the wood, the, you know, the various parts of the ship are kind of laying around the beach. He said, over the course of days, weeks, months, the wind, the sun, the sand, the waves begin to wear away at those pieces of the ship. And he points particularly to the rigging, the rope. You know, that rigging begins to disintegrate. But, you know, if you think about, you know, unpack this analogy a little bit. If you went to that beach every day and tried to see, okay, how much of that rope has rotted away today? You know, you wouldn't notice any difference. But over the course of time, this gradual wearing away, almost imperceptible, not even consciously recognizable at times. And then one day you go to that beach and try to pick up that rope and it falls apart in your hand. To me, this is so much of how my own practice has unfolded. I had a few of those moments of like, wow, something really, really releasing in a moment. But the vast majority of it has been this gradual, gradual wearing away that I can look back and say, yeah, 20 years ago, different mind, really different mind. And not really know how it all unfolded, but having a deep confidence that it was the Dharma that wore away at that reactivity. And so as these reactive states release, this natural movement towards metta, again, compassion, a relationship with the world. I love the relational quality of this text. It really keeps pointing us back to, it's not just about sitting isolated somewhere. That these qualities are experienced in relationship to ourselves, to the world, to experience. And then the mind of freedom. It reminds me of the instruction Gil offered this morning, the pointing to sometimes the instructions are about directing attention, meeting something. Sometimes the instructions are about receiving experience. In both of those cases, there can still be a little bit of sense of me in there. I'm looking at experience. I'm directing attention. Experience is happening to me in receiving attention, receiving experience. And then he pointed to neither receiving or directing. Awareness, awaring. Compassion, compassioning. Wisdom, engaging. Not me. Not mine, not who I am. Released, at peace.